Yes? No? The cosmology problems. Yes. They were easy. No, that's the, there were people telling me they were, the problems were easy. Okay, so maybe they weren't that easy. But so here's the question. How many of you have had cosmology before? Just raise your hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yeah, I think so, 7 or 8 people. Okay, so maybe that's not the majority. But okay, so hopefully, so we can, well, we can, so some of the stuff I'm going to tell you might seem repetitive, but, and sound boring. Hopefully, we're going to make it exciting somehow. But so today, I was planning to talk about cosmological kinematics. So now, there is something that might be puzzling for you. You may think that you need general relativity to describe the structure of the universe on larger scales. You might have heard it, and that's actually true. But then in last, well, yesterday you managed to derive equations for cosmological dynamics, for the Friedmann equations, just based on Newtonian mechanics. So you might wonder why you need general relativity at all to describe cosmology. And that's a question that, I mean, I'd like you to think about, and it's a very deep and important question. It has to do with the fact that essentially, so general relativity, well, GR, locally, it always reduces to a special relativity. Which at low velocities becomes Newtonian mechanics. So that was the reason, that's really the reason that if you have a universe that's homogeneous and isotropic, locally you can use a special relativity to treat it, and you don't have to worry about the curvature of the space-time. And locally, you can also, based on the Hubble law, you know that velocities are small, much less than the speed of light. So Newtonian mechanics is a good description of what's going on. That's why that for the local behavior of general relativistic objects, Newtonian mechanics, assuming that they are not relativistic, Newtonian mechanics is a good thing. But is that appropriate tool? That's not always the case, especially if you're not talking about local observables. If you're talking about global observables, then you need the full general relativistic treatment. And that's why we really need a general relativistic theory of cosmology. So today I'm going to tell you about the geometry of cosmic expansion. Tomorrow we'll talk more about the dynamics. Now, the difference between the geometry and dynamics is that the geometry, you don't really need to know the theory that governs the space-time curvatures, such as general relativity, or maybe some other more generalized theory of gravity. For kinematics, all you need to know are the symmetries that govern the space, and that essentially tells you everything. So, in particular, in cosmology, we have the so-called cosmological principle, which I believe the first time, actually I'm not very clear on its history, but at least Einstein was the person who first introduced it, or people at that. And Einstein and his contemporaries. It's still not obvious why it must be correct, but it states that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. Isotropic. on larger scales. So essentially means that every point in the universe, for a given time, or at a given time, and you may worry what you mean by a given time, because of course time is not absolute in general relativity. But that's really how this principle is stated. At a given time, every point in the universe is exactly the same as every other point in the universe. It has the same density, the same local physics. And also, every direction in the universe is like any other direction in the universe. So it's not obvious that this must be true, especially around Einstein's time it wasn't obvious. At that time, it was certainly just a simplifying assumption. And the fact that it happened to be true, to the best of our understanding right now, it's an amazing coincidence that the first guess of scientists some 8 years ago happens to be correct now. Yes?
In what sense is it correct, since it does not rigorously make any sense, because there is no such thing as every point in the universe at a given time?
Yeah, well, so there is, so we can make it more rigorous. But, so that's, of course, that's the thing about abstract principles, that they are not exactly always true, but they give you a tool to construct things. And then you can add bells and whistles on top of it that break that principle in an absolute sense. But if you didn't have that principle to begin with, you didn't know where to start. So that's the sense it is. It's very helpful. But it also that it is actually, it happens to be correct. If you, so the points are not exactly the same, but they're approximately the same. Of course, question of what approximately means, that's the main question. That's something we can discuss in more detail. Essentially, if you look at averages of quantities on larger scales, they happen to be the same. On the smaller scales, they are not. You have planets, you have stars, you have galaxies. They are definitely not the same. But then you average things over a scale of hundreds of megaparsec, things look as if they are more or less uniform, homogeneous, and isotropic. Yes?
So on large scales, he said that the principle says that things should be isotropic, but you said it's not obvious. So would you expect a preferred direction of some sort?
Well, there could be, but we haven't found it yet.
Why do we say it's not obvious?
There is no way to prove that there is no preferred direction. There could always be a preferred direction, but for some reason we haven't been able to find it. So maybe there is a preferred direction which interacts in some weak way with other things that we observe, but we have so that because of the weakness of that interaction, we haven't detected the signatures of that. Yes.
On a related note, how much can we constrain like inhomogeneity of the universe outside the whole volume? Like obviously,
not much. Not really, essentially. So, I mean, the rough answer is that we cannot. You can put constraints on the gradients of the quantities. But yeah, so the thing is that Hubble radius is how far, essentially, you can see. And things that are happening farther from that distance, farther from the horizon, you cannot really constrain very well. But these are all very good and important questions. And this is something that people are still questioning to this day. But what's amazing is that there has been no concrete evidence against it over the past 8 years. So let's start from here. And that's where people who had the metric theory of gravity, theory of GR, started first. So let's do a simple thing. What is the most general metric that's consistent with this assumption? It's homogeneous and isotropic in every point in the space. So of course, the example of something that's homogeneous and isotropic at every point is a sphere, right? But of course, our universe is three-dimensional. So if our universe is supposed to be a sphere, it should be maybe a three-dimensional sphere or a three-sphere in a four-space, as opposed to a regular sphere that we know. So the surface of a sphere is two-dimensional, or has two spatial dimensions. But if our universe looks like a sphere, it should be a tree sphere, basically. Should have a three-dimensional surface. So let's say that this is the case, that you have we happen to live in a tree sphere. And a tree sphere is probably the most general example of with some caveat that I'm going to mention later, a most general example of a universe, a spatial surface, which is homogeneous and isotropic. Every point is like every other point. So what is the definition of a sphere? The points that are a constant distance from all the points that are at a constant distance from another point. And for historical reason, and for reason that becomes clear, I'm going to call that distance k to the minus 1, or square root of k to the minus 1. So capital R is the radius of the sphere. But I'm going to call R square k to the minus 1. And that's just for historical reason. So x and y, x, y, and z are just Cartesian coordinates. And w is a fourth a spatial coordinate that we don't really see. So let's say that this is the sphere in a four-dimensional space. Now, this is not how. I don't know if it's the best way to plot it, but say x, y, z, and w. And you happen to live on the surface of this sphere that's a constant distance from the center of the coordinate system. So if you live on the surface of the sphere, you really have only three independent coordinates. So these four coordinates are not independent. They are related by this. So let's assume that this x and y and z are our ordinary Cartesian coordinates. But w is now a function of these. So if these are the Cartesian coordinates, then this is r squared. And w will be a square root of k to the minus 1 minus r squared, right? Now, the line element, dl squared, is dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared plus dw squared. And so I'm assuming that this four-dimensional space is Euclidean. And I'm just talking about Euclidean signatures right now. So let's forget about time for now. Just talking about now. The first step I want to take is tell you how a spatial surface, which is homogeneous and isotropic, looks like. And I'm just now forgetting about time. So this is just your spatial line element, the proper length, if you will. Now, of course, if the four-dimensional space is Euclidean and has flat metric, that doesn't mean that the metric on the sphere is going to be flat. The same way that when you go from Cartesian coordinates to spherical coordinates, your metric changes, and it's not going to be it is really a flat metric, but it's not going to be the standard 1-1-1 metric. You're going to get sines and cosines and things of that sort. So what happens here is, since w is a function of r, so first let's recognize that this part is just a spherical coordinate line element. So this part, I can write it as dr squared plus r squared d theta squared plus sine theta squared, sine squared of theta d phi squared. So that's just this part. I'm just going from Cartesian coordinates to spherical coordinates. So that's a standard. dw, I can plug it from here. It's going to be, so dw is going to be minus r dr divided by a square root of k inverse minus r squared. So I just square this thing and plug it in here. It's going to be r squared dr squared divided by k inverse minus r squared. Right? So I end up with a metric of a tree sphere which if I now add this term, both of these terms are proportional to dr squared. So if I add them and take the common denominator in the numerator, r squared cancel, and what you end up with is just dr squared plus r squared. This thing, people usually call it d omega squared. It's just the angular part of the metric, which has a spherical symmetry. So is it clear what I've done? I just added this term to this term, taking the common denominator. Sorry? Well, so there is a k inverse in numerator and a k inverse here. So there was k inverse here, and there's a k inverse here. And I multiply both numerator and denominator by k inverse. So this thing goes away. This becomes 1 minus kr squared. So this is how a metric on a 3S sphere looks like. And r is essentially, let's make it more, can you all see this here? Yes, okay. So you have three coordinates on a 3S sphere, theta, phi, which I abbreviated them in this d omega squared, and r. Essentially like three angles, as opposed to two angles that you have on a 2S sphere, you have now three angles. Now the other thing is that there is a maximum to r. You see, r squared plus w squared is k inverse. So r is always less than basically k to the minus 1/2, which is the same as, but actually, am I saying this right? Yeah, r is always less than k to the minus 1/2, which is the same as capital R. Right? And you see that when r becomes equal to k to the minus 1/2, this metric becomes singular, so you cannot really trust it beyond that point. Now, what that means is that when you are in this 3S sphere, the r is a distance from some origin, and essentially, when r go at this point, it can be equal as well. At that point, you reach the other pole of the sphere. So at r equal to 0, you are, say, on the north pole of the sphere. At r equal to capital R, you are at the south pole of the sphere, and that's it. So that's how big your universe is. This is only the spatial part, by the way. So I'm not talking about time yet. If k is 0, then this metric is the same metric as a 3S flat space. Then that's the limit where the radius of this 3S sphere goes to infinity. So you just have a flat space. This space, your 3S space is not curved anymore. It's just flat. Yes?
So this R is like an angle now?
Yes. Although, it's not, this maximum, it's not an actual angle in a sense that it doesn't go, it's changed only by this amount. I can do a change of coordinate in that new coordinate, it exactly looks like theta and phi. But R up to a change of variable is like an angle. So, yeah.
And how do we see that r equals 0 is at the top of the sphere and...
Well, r equals to 0 is one point. So, of course, every point is like every other point.
Sure.
So you can say any point is the top of the sphere. And now what you can see from here is that there's a maximum to r. So r is like a distance from a point because... because of this metric, essentially, that r has a minimum. So that's in a sense, that's like a distance, right? Because, minimum of r is 0. R cannot be less than 0. And that's easy to see from here. Yeah, I mean, this metric, if at the small r's, this is like a spherical coordinate metric, right? If this term wasn't there. And so that's like a distance from the center, from some point. And you don't care about curvature at the small distances. Now, at large distances, this term does become important. And what it does is it curves the space and eventually limits the maximum r. For r, when r gets, becomes equal to k to the minus 1/2, then this metric becomes singular. And there is nothing, it's not well defined really beyond that point, essentially because of this relationship. R has a maximum, which is k inverse. So let's see. So let's see. I guess one way to see this, I guess one way to answer this question is that if you think of it this way, so you have you have x, y, z, but the sum of their quadratures is r squared. So let's call this direction r, and this direction is w, right? And r squared plus w squared is capital R squared. So at r equal to 0, cap w squared is equal to r squared. You're up here. As w decreases, r increases. And so I'm a bit confused as to what I'm doing here. Is this correct? No, sorry. I think I'm doing the other. So this is R. This is W. No. Okay. Okay. So for some reason I'm a bit confused about what I'm doing.
Well, didn't you say that R was like the
article? Yeah. So R equal to 0 is up here. So R must be something like this. Well, it's not an actual angle. Well, yeah, it is. I suppose it's like an angle. Yeah. Sorry? Yeah. Well, I'm just saying that since r squared plus w squared are constant, then you are on something that looks like this. So you are on this circle, right? Okay. Now r equal to 0 could be either here at this point or at this point. And somehow, so what am I trying to say? Yeah. I'm a bit confused about what I'm trying to say.
Why can't you let r be negative?
But because I've defined r as basically the Cartesian as a distance, x squared plus distance from the center, x squared plus y squared plus z squared. So I mean, distances cannot be negative. Yeah. Okay. So let me think about this. I'm a bit confused about this picture. I guess I was drawing this morning. I do not think. Yeah. But this is an easy enough problem, right? So let's think about this. I'm a bit confused because, so here R has a maximum and then its minimum is again 0.
It looks like a different sphere. Like this circle and the sphere are two different things, no?
Why is it a sphere? It's a circle.
That's a circle. Yeah. But there's also the sphere.
Yeah.
That we live in.
So I guess in a way I'm summarizing this. So this is a square root of x squared plus y squared plus z squared. Okay. So the thing I'm confused about is, let me think about this. Let's move on. What I guess what I'm trying to see is, What is the conversion from R to the angular coordinate?
If you set this from R to be 0, uh-huh. Your W will be plus or minus big R.
Yes.
So in your regular force here, you will get fixed force.
That's right. So R equals to 0 are these 2 points. Okay? Yes. Now, as R is increasing, I could be either moving in this direction or moving in this direction. So there are really, for any R, there are really two possibilities. Either I'm here or I'm here, right? And there's a maximum when R approaches capital R, then there's only one place that I can be, W equals to 0. So that's... So that's really the picture, and I mean this is yes.
Yeah, is there like another universe for R bigger than k inverse until infinity?
Well, I don't think that's, but at least for positive k inverse that doesn't happen, right? Yeah. Now one thing is that k could be negative. Now that wouldn't be a sphere anymore. That would be a hyperboloid. But that's another possibility. So let's have this picture in the back of our mind, and you can think about what these different coordinates mean. But the point so far is that this is the metric on a triosphere. Okay. So one thing you can do is to actually measure distance. Actually, what is the angle from if you start from this point? Go to another point. So the thing is that R and W are not really, neither of them are the distance on the sphere. The distance is L, which is integral of dL. So the integral of dL at the proper distance from the pole of the sphere is given by the integral of, so say you're not changing the angles, you're fixing theta and phi, but you're moving from the pole to another point. Let's call that chi. And that's given by the integral of dr divided by a square root of 1 minus kr squared. Right? So this is just dl. This is just integral of dl. Correct? So this integral has a closed form and is 1 over a square root of k sine inverse of k, a square root of k times r. Okay? So this is the actual proper distance. And this one maximizes at... So this is sine inverse. As R increases, sine inverse increases until... So what is the maximum of sine inverse? Yeah. Well, this is the coordinate that's equivalent to the angle up to this square root of k. So if a square root of k was 1, then this chi is the angle. And this thing, in principle, that should maximize at pi, basically, which is on the other side of the sphere. So you start from here, you go you go all the way to the other pole. And this would be pi. So why is pi maximum of psi inverse? I guess it's not.
Because we constrain the range to make it a function, to make it a 1-1 function.
Okay.
It's cyclic. That's how we constrain the range from minus.
So that is x. Okay. Go ahead.
But it's also, I mean, it's the maximum of this integral. Because this integral doesn't give any sine inverse. It gives only that particular sine inverse, I guess, from minus pi to pi.
If it gives the sine.
Yes.
Sine
inverse
is
simplified. Sorry, go ahead.
Is just defined from minus pi to pi or minus pi over 2?
It should
because it's multivaluated, no?
Yeah, this is multivariable. At a small k, this is just going to be proportional to r. Give me a second. But as r increases, the full integral is sine inverse, and somehow I think this is pi over 2.
Yes.
It is pi over 2.
Yeah, it is pi over 2 because when you use coordinates r, theta, phi,
mm-hmm.
your r goes from 0 at the north pole to the maximum r at the equator, and you can't go further because else you would be multivariate.
Perfect. So that's exactly what happened. So essentially what happens is that you reach a maximum r, and that's at pi over 2, right? That's half of the full angle. And if you want to go farther, you should go back in r. So essentially this r, every r, describes 2 points on this circle, not 1 point. So this is always less than pi over 2, essentially, which is the same as pi r over 2. So beyond that, this coordinate system just folds back on itself, you could say. So this is what the closest thing to an angle on a sphere. If a square root of k was 1, this would be the angle on a sphere, because it maximizes at pi over 2, right? R is not, so you could choose to use either chi or r. What's interesting about chi is like an angle on a free sphere, so you might like that. What's interesting about r is that your angular part is the standard flat space part, angular metric. So sometimes people use r, sometimes people use chi. If k is 0, the two are the same. If k is not 0, then they have two different meanings. Now, the other thing is that you could have k negative. OK, so where should I erase? Let's erase here. So people, what people usually do is you can do a coordinate rescaling. Make k, if k is 0, then it's chi equals to r. If k is positive, you can just do a coordinate rescaling and make it 1. So this is a flat universe. So your metric is flat if k is equal to 0, which is three special flat directions. If k is plus 1, it's just like an ordinary sphere with radius capital R. So it's called a closed universe. And the reason is that it has a finite volume. For that, chi equals sine inverse of r. Right? Now, the thing that's not obvious from this analysis is that k can actually be negative. And you can think of it as, if you don't think of the higher dimensional picture, so either you can think of it as a hyperboloid instead of a sphere, if k is negative. Or you can think of it as just a three sphere, forget about the higher dimensional picture, and say that this metric, I can just analytically continue k from positive values to negative values. And if this is a homogeneous anisotropic spacetime, it will still remain a homogeneous anisotropic spacetime, but with a different k. And it's... And since it's a hyperboloid, it's called an open universe. So this, if k is positive, it doesn't have a boundary. And chi becomes a hyperbolic sine inverse of r. Basically, what you do if you replace k by minus 1 here, and sine inverse becomes hyperbolic sine inverse. And this thing doesn't have a maximum. So that's why the universe is open. It doesn't have any boundary. Or, well, doesn't have a finite volume. Actually, this universe never has a boundary, the same way that the space that sphere never has a boundary. But this has an infinite volume. This has a finite volume. Of course, you don't have to make this rescaling. If k is anything other than these numbers, then this is the general formula for chi. So Now, this is only a space. Of course, general relativity is a theory of a space-time curvature. Right? And I haven't told you anything about the space-time yet, or about the time yet. Now, before I do that, are there any questions? No. So, in a space-time, so I cannot draw a four-dimensional space. I'm going to try to draw a projection of a 2+1-dimensional space. You have particles of matter, say dark matter or other, or radiation or other stuff that are, that have their own Bohr lines. And you can think of constant density surfaces. So if you have any type of particles in the universe, you can draw constant density surfaces because the density is a scalar. For a perfect fluid, its density is a scalar. And this homogeneous anisotropic conditions is an assumption for this sort of surfaces. Now, it doesn't have to be constant density. It could be constant pressure surfaces. It could be surfaces that are normal to these trajectories. Now, there you could have a cosmological principle for any of those surfaces. But the most general one is, if it's true, well, I guess the most strict one, let's say, is if the cosmological principle is true for all possible surfaces that you define based on either constant density or constant pressure or constant everything. So that tells me that this surface, based on arguments that I gave you here, this surface should have this spatial metric if it's a homogeneous and isotropic surface. Now, at some other time, you're going to have a different surface. But if it's still homogeneous and isotropic, it should have this form, maybe a slightly different curvature. But it should still have this form. And k, I can always rescale it by a coordinate redefinition. Just you can rescale r to r times the constant. Can make k, if k is positive, I can make k plus 1. If k is negative, I can make k minus 1. Or I can fix it to be any constant that I want by a coordinate redefinition. So then I can generally say that the spatial part of metric up to a overall rescaling is always the same. So let's write down the full metric now. So there is a spatial part, which is this. Now, this could be, so this general form is the same at all times. But then there could be an overall rescaling from one time to another. Let's call that A of t, A squared of t. You could have a term that looks like g0i, the let's say dx. Let's make more room here. You could have g0i dt dxi, and you could have g00 dt squared. So this is the S squared. This is the full space-time metric. Now, if you have an isotropic universe, there is no special direction, right? And this G0i defines a vector. So if you want an isotropic universe, G0i must be 0. And G0, now, it could be a function of a space and time. But if you define this, if you want a homogeneous universe, then G00 would be only a function of time. And then you can redefine whatever this integral is, or you can define tau to be integral of a square root of g naught naught dt, you call this then your new time. And then this term becomes just d tau squared. Or let's call this, if this is the old time, this is the new time. So assuming a special homogeneity and isotropy, the general metric is, well, if you want to have Lorentzian signature, it's going to be something that looks like this. Okay, so this is what's known as, yes?
Why don't you introduce like a t dependence in k instead of on the overall term, on the, including the r squared d theta?
Yeah. Well, the reason is that I can always do a rescaling of r. Okay. So I can say if k is a function of t, okay. So let's say you have k of t. I can call k of t times r, call this r prime, let's say. Right? And say if k is positive, let's say I do this, and then this thing becomes 1 minus kr prime, just 1 minus r prime squared. And both of these terms will be proportional to k, which I can get out, but I can basically factor out and absorbing the definition of a. Right? Yes?
Is it possible to treat this in the same way, the case where k changes sign?
Now, that's a very good question. And believe it or not, I have thought about that, but I don't know the answer to it. That's a good question to think about. Maybe you can answer it. It seems that if you have a universe that's open, at least globally, that cannot turn to a universe that's closed, because this has a finite volume, the other doesn't have a finite volume. But of course, these are all, what we are talking about are really local descriptions. The global description of a full sphere, that doesn't need to be the case. That doesn't need to hold. I mean, this picture could be true only locally in a small volume of the universe. And in that small volume, I don't think there's anything that keeps you from changing the sign of k. Maybe with the right theory of gravity, that does happen. In general relativity, it doesn't. K is actually a constant of motion. And that's the constant that actually appeared in yesterday's tutorial. There was a constant of motion that was energy of test particles. And that's the constant, which happens to be the same as this constant. Now, could there be any other theory of gravity where k changes sign? I don't know. I think maybe this is something you can think about and find an answer to. So let's see. So I have a few grounds to cover. As always, slower than I expected. Let's see. So this is the celebrated Friedman, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker metric. And this is what all cosmology is based on. I can do a few more derivations for you. And I really started late, so I'm going to take a lot of time. So I guess Robert Speckens, he has to suffer for Michael Peskin. So one thing so there are a few definitions, and they may sound boring, but actually they come in handy eventually when you want to use all this stuff. One is the so-called conformal time. I can actually factor out this A out of everything. And I introduce this new time variable, d eta. Um, So now this part, there is no time dependence in it. This is completely static. All the time dependencies factor out in this conformal factor. And eta is just defined as the integral of dt over a. So this is known as a conformal time. Because in terms of this time, your metric is essentially a static up to a conformal factor. So this is what people call a conformal factor. And one thing that is interesting about these conformal metrics is that the conformal photons or massless particles don't care about conformal factors. So if you solve for geodesic equations for photons, turns out that the conformal factors drop out of them. So the photons don't see this time dependence. They just see this part. As long as you describe things in terms of this conformal time and your coordinates. In particular, if k is equal to 0, as far as photons are concerned, in terms of these coordinates, it's a flat universe. It's a Minkowski spacetime. So that's what's relevant for conformal time, what's interesting and important about this use of conformal time. One thing, for example, is that that's interesting is if you see the static coordinate system, as far as the photons are concerned, let's say that you have, so let me draw this somewhere else. I guess I could use this other board as well, but it's too late. Let's say you're sitting here. So this is time, and this is a space R, let's say. You send you receive two signals from another, from, say, a star. Let's say this is eta and R. Now, since this is a static metric, this trajectory can be exactly the same as this trajectory. So this delta eta here is the same as this delta eta here. So nothing really changes in this. As I said, the photons don't care about the conformal rescaling of metric. So this is a static metric. So delta eta of emission is the same as delta eta of observation. So these are, let's say, photons. There are two signals that are emitted and then are observed. But then remember the definition of eta. Eta is integral of dt over a. So this says that delta t of emission divided by a at emission is delta t at observation divided by a at observation, right? And remember, let's say the ratio of delta t's, these time periods, is the inverse of the ratio of frequencies, because frequency is inversely proportional to delta t. So I mean, what I'm thinking is you could think of these at different peaks. If you have a wave that's coming to you, and it has this is the first peak, and this is the second peak of the wave. Delta t is the difference between the period of the wave, for example. So what is known or defined as redshift is the ratio of emitted frequency divided by observed frequency. And you can use this relationship. So this is the ratio is the inverse of delta t's, which gives you a emission, or sorry, a observed divided by a emission. If you just plot from here. And if you have, let's say observation is happening now, that's you call that A0. This is usually zero indexes for today. And emission is happening at some time in the past. You call that just A at some arbitrary time. So if you have a star some point in the past that emits a light, it's going to be redshifted by this ratio that's given by the ratio of a scale factor then and a scale factor now. OK? So this is cosmological redshift. Yes?
For the expansion, no?
Yes.
Maybe.
Sorry, what is the question?
This redshift is, this displacement of the frequency is just for the expansion.
Yeah, it's because of the expansion.
If you have 2 points at the no velocity, no R.
No velocity.
You have redshift.
Yeah. So these are points that are at rest in this co-moving coordinate system. They are constant R and constant angles. So this is for those. If the points are moving in this coordinate system, then you have to add the Doppler shift or whatever other thing you have. But this derivation is only strictly valid if you assume this metric and assume that your emitting and absorbing observers are at rest.
When the universe is expanding, what does it mean that the 2 points are at rest?
Well, that's a good thing. So you know that's a very good question. So you know in general relativity, the coordinates are kind of arbitrary. You can the coordinates could move or your coordinates could be fixed. So you could always choose a coordinates which are moving with your particles. So then in those coordinates, your particles are always at rest. Or you could choose the coordinate system which is not moving with the particles, and then particles are moving. Now, in this particular case, we have chosen a coordinate system that by construction, this was the coordinate system that all the particles are sitting at rest. And hence, this is a co-moving coordinate. And so let's see. Now, I'm not sure if that answers your question. So these are called co-moving coordinates. And essentially, the reason is that you can show that r and theta and phi equal to constant are geodesics in this coordinate. So particles, if they are at rest in these coordinates, they remain at rest. So you could also choose a coordinate system which is not like this, but then that wouldn't be a co-moving coordinate system. And in that coordinate system, particles are moving, and you would think of this redshift as a Doppler shift, as opposed to effect 2-2 metric. So it's not really possible to differentiate between a Doppler shift and like a general relativistic redshift in a general relativistic context. Yes?
Can we say that in one case only A changes and the coordinates don't change?
Yeah, well, in principle, yes. So if you have particles that are at rest, are sitting there, then they can always sit there. And their position of the particles doesn't change. But the proper distance between the particles does change. That's the lesson here. Another way to think about it is that if you have waves, in this space-time, the co-moving wavelength, which are measured in this coordinate system, doesn't change. But the proper wavelength, which is given by the physical wavelength, which is A times the wavelength in these coordinates, that sense. So if you have a wave in this space-time, assuming that you start with a plane wave, the co-moving wavelength doesn't change, but then that means that since everything is scaled by A of t, the physical wavelength as observed by a ruler is going to be a scaling like A of t, which is so this segment is equivalent to a redshift that the scale is 1 over a. Because wavelengths are getting longer, that means frequencies are getting lower.
It doesn't have to be a redshift, does it? If the a's are decreasing,
it could be a blue shift. Yeah, it could be It could be a blue shift if A is decreasing. The universe happens to be expanding, so that seems to be what's happening. Okay, so I have to rush through this. Something that follows from this, if you have a black body photon bath, its temperature is going to be decreasing the same way by this redshift factor. So if you have like photons of the cosmic microwave in the background, they'd be redshifting as the universe is expanding. So there are two things I guess that I should mention and then wrap up. Let's erase this. And these are basically definitions of distances. And so, by the way, how much time do you think I have?
Minus 10 minutes?
I started at 12 past 10, I should say. Okay.
So if it's 1 hour, you're fine.
Yeah. Okay. So there are, I guess I can just write this down without much details. So there are two types of, so this space is not a flat space. It has these weird properties. There are two things that are in particular important for observations. The so-called angular diameter distance and luminosity distance. So this is dA, and this is dL. And so for angular diameter distance, this is defined as essentially if you see something at a distance, if something subtends an angle delta theta in the sky, then its physical length is dA. So the L physical is going to be dA times delta theta. And the luminosity distance is defined as the observed flux. If you have a candle or a star some distance, its actual rest frame luminosity is L, then the observed flux is going to be L divided by 4 pi dL squared. And we can derive both these. They're going to be both proportional to R, but they're not going to be the same. So let me delay the derivation of this till tomorrow. Or you can think about it yourself as well. But I'm going to delay the derivation of these things till tomorrow. And these are both important for interpreting observations. Yes? It's a luminosity, let's say. This is length, basically. So the physical size. That's right. So let's say size. And this is luminosity. OK, good. Thank you.